in packaging.
I want to end with where you started, your dedication. You write, by design, low-income people in communities of color bear the burden of plastics. The destructive web of plastics gathers in their neighborhoods, rivers, air, and bodies. We dedicate this book to those living in the shadow of plastics facilities in Louisiana, Texas, Appalachia, and elsewhere, in the sincere belief that they should live in a world beyond plastics, and that such a world is within our reach. Final 20 seconds.
Thank you, Amy. I mean, the environmental justice issues are quite severe. People are getting sick living near these plastic production facilities. Johns Hopkins did a study saying the cancer rate in Cancer Alley is 7 times the national average. So even if you don't live in those communities, by reducing plastic and getting laws to reduce plastic, we're helping our sisters and brothers in Cancer Alley in Texas and Appalachia.
Judith Henk, I want to thank you for being with us. Former EPA Regional Administrator, President of Beyond Plastics. Her new book is The Problem with Plastic: How We Can Save Ourselves and Our Planet Before It's Too Late. And that does it for our show. I'm Amy Goodman. This is another edition of Democracy Now!
Listening to KBOO Portland at 90.7 FM.
Don't know what to get your loved ones this season? Check out kboo.fm/merch to snag some KBOO swag to support community media in style. While you're shopping for gifts, you can make donations to help support KBOO's $75,000 goal for our KBOO Fights Back campaign. Now through December 31st.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. The nominating committee meets on the second Tuesday of the month at 6 p.m. This month's meeting will be held online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting virtually can be found on our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on this end-of-year membership drive special of the KBOO Evening News, an atmospheric river means flood risk for the metro area.
Water quality regulations for Oregon factory farms are up for review.
And Eastern Oregon gets its own bus service restored.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Monday, December 8th, 2025. KBOO is currently in our end-of-year membership drive, and we'd like to urge you to become a member by going online to kboo.fm/give. I'm Terrence Burns.
And I'm Dave Johnson. Drivers, watch out for flooding and landslides this week. An atmospheric river has hit the Pacific Northwest, bringing lots of rain throughout Wednesday. The National Weather Service reports that heavy rainfall will increase risk for rivers, small streams, and urban flooding. Landslides are also at risk. High tides may bring coastal flooding. These risks will continue into Thursday evening. And the National Weather Service recommends that those who live in floodplains have a plan in place. Drivers should not drive in flooded roads.
Director of the Portland Housing Bureau, Helmi Heiserich, was put on leave by Mayor Keith Wilson and subsequently resigned. This comes after the mayor missed self-imposed deadline for ending homelessness in the city earlier this month. In the past, when city leaders are placed on leave, it means they've been given the option to either resign or be fired. She sent a letter to City Council about her termination last week. She says she was pushed out of trying to push the council's social housing policy forward, and she was blamed for millions in unspent revenue and told to keep quiet about it. Heisrich was hired in early 2024 to lead the Portland Housing Bureau. Her strategy focused on establishing more affordable housing in the city and new models of building publicly run housing. In her resignation letter, Heisrich said she is not an expert in shelters. She does, quote, know what it takes to build a world-class housing system, unquote. She's also said she's helped the city roll out more than $100 million in new affordable housing programs and won $20 million in grants for the city's housing bureau. She wrote, quote, despite these achievements, I was surprised to be asked to step down without notice that my work was unsatisfactory, unquote. The news came as a shock to several city councilors who had been working with her on housing policies. Councilor Jamie Dunphy, vice chair of the city's Housing and Homelessness Committee, said, quote, Helmy was a brilliant policy mind with deep experience that was directly relevant to the work the city needs for the decade or two decades, unquote.
On Wednesday, Portland City Council will hold a confirmation vote on Portland's new city administrator. Last week, Mayor Keith Wilson named Raymond Lee as his choice for the long-term position. Lee would come to Portland from Greeley, Colorado, where he was city manager. If confirmed by the council, Lee's position here in Portland would have a larger scope than his previous one in Greeley. In Greeley, Lee oversaw 1,600 employees with $515 million in budget. In Portland, he would oversee a 6,500-person workforce and an annual budget of $8.6 billion. The City of Portland highlighted some of Lee's prior accomplishments in a press release. In Greeley, Lee oversaw an urban core revitalization project and the creation of a 300-acre entertainment and housing district. Lee also oversaw the creation of Greeley's Housing Services and Homelessness Solutions Departments. In years prior, Lee held city positions in Dallas and Amarillo, Texas. The city council will also vote on a resolution to ask the new city administrator to prepare a report for recommendations on the city's process for design review for the new building's developments. The resolution was introduced by Councilor Eric Zimmerman and Councilor Annalita Murillo. The goal of the resolution is to evaluate roadblocks in the design review process to encourage residential and commercial development in Portland. Other items on City Council's docket include ratifying a collective bargaining agreement with the Portland Police Association. They will also ratify a bargaining agreement with the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees, AFSCME, Local 189.
The permit that regulates water quality for confined animal feeding operations, CAFOs, in Oregon is up for renewal, and the public is invited to submit comments. Though there have been some added regulations to the statewide permitting process, clean water advocates say lawmakers aren't going far enough to protect public health and the environment. Isabel Charlet has more on the story.
Oregon is renewing its statewide water quality permit for confined animal feeding operations, also known as CAFOs. The previous permit expired 4 years ago. While recent state legislation requires some improved protections, advocates say the permits still fall short of shielding the state's ground and surface water from contaminants that are commonly found in CAFO wastewater. Tara Heinzen with Food and Water Watch says the permits do not include a process for monitoring wastewater disposal, which she calls a cornerstone of the federal Clean Water Act.
These facilities are spreading liquid waste on fields and sometimes spreading it in excess of what the land can absorb. But if you're not out there to watch it and to monitor the water quality, you might not know if violations are taking place.
Heinzen explains the waste from CAFOs contains nitrates, bacteria, pharmaceuticals, and heavy metals, all of which can pollute waterways and drinking water. She adds this contamination has already created a decades-long crisis in areas like the lower Umatilla Basin in eastern Oregon. Alice Morrison of Friends of Family Farmers highlights positive changes in the permitting process from Senate Bill 85, which passed in 2020. She says large facilities built where groundwater is already contaminated must now obtain an individual permit. She adds CAFOs use large amounts of water, and now all CAFOs must provide a water supply plan, and new facilities are limited to 12,000 gallons per day without an additional water right.
There are some facilities in the state that use hundreds of thousands of gallons of water per day, some as much as small cities. 12,000 gallons a day is only enough for about 200 dairy cows.
Oregon is accepting public comments until December 22nd on the updated CAFO water permit, with a hearing scheduled for December 16th. Heinzen says Food and Water Watch and allied groups plan to submit comments advocating for a stronger permitting process that better protects waterways and public health, and she encourages anyone who cares about this issue to do the same. For Public News Service, I'm Isabel Charlet.
A new bus route is going to be installed in northeast Oregon, restoring bus service to Portland and Boise. Service for the bus line begins on December 15th. The service will connect Hermiston, Baker, LeGrand, Ontario, Boardman, Nampa, which all lost connections to Portland. This comes a little less than a year since they lost bus service to their closest major cities. The bus line is run by Northwest Stage Lines. The service is funded by a one-year startup grant from the Oregon Department of Transportation. This new route will bring back daily bus service to the region after FlexiBus, formerly Greyhound, left 11 months ago. It will cut the current transit time from 9 hours to just 3. Tickets are currently available for later this month. Northwest Stage Lines says the price will vary based on day and destination. A one-way ticket from Boise to Portland is currently $89.60. The bus will be able to connect with long-distance lines such as Greyhound and Amtrak in Portland, Boise, and Pasco, Washington.
Libraries across the U.S. are celebrating the partial restoration of federal funds after a judge ruled that President Trump's executive order to shut down the Institute of Museum and Library Services is unlawful. Suzanne Potter has more from California.
Librarians are breathing a sigh of relief as the Trump administration is quietly restoring $160 million in funding for libraries across the U.S., including $15 million for the Golden State. President Donald Trump signed an executive order in March to gut the Institute of Museum and Library Services, calling it unnecessary. But now a federal judge has declared that order unlawful. Anthony Chow is president of the California Library Association and a professor and director of the School of Information at San Jose State University.
I have heard a lot of excitement, but also skepticism, because a lot of people have been laid off. A lot of projects have been dismantled. And so while we're excited that the funds are returned, there is a little bit of skepticism in terms of whether it might be taken away again.
While the funding already approved by Congress must be dispersed, any future funding is up in the air. During his first term, Trump zeroed out funds for the Institute of Museum and Library Sciences every year, only to have them restored by Congress in the final budget. Funding from the Institute supports ebook collections, community impact grants, literacy programs, and workforce development. Meanwhile, California's 1,200 libraries are taking another $70 million hit after the Trump administration terminated the Digital Equity Grant Program. Chow says the program, created during the Biden administration, was designed to make sure no one is left behind in the modern era.
The act was designed to ensure that everyone, regardless of income, language, age, or geography, could fully participate in the digital world. Libraries were prepared to deliver much of this work through digital skills training, device lending, telehealth support, and essential online access.
The California Library Association is asking Governor Gavin Newsom to include $12.7 million in state funds for libraries in his January state budget proposal. Support for this reporting was provided by the Philanthropic Foundation, Carnegie Corporation of New York. For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
Indiana and Florida advanced redrawn congressional maps as part of the redistricting race. Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth discusses boat strikes, and New Orleans mayor-elect speaks on ICE raids. With those stories and more, it's Edwin J. Vieira with 2025 Talks.
Welcome to 2025 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
You have an opportunity to go back home and tell your constituents you did the right thing, because you know this is not the right thing. You know this is going to tear our state apart.
Democratic Indiana State Representative Carolyn Jackson is decrying a Republican-led redistricting plan which just passed the State House in spite of a dozen in the GOP voting no. The bill faces an unclear future in the Senate, but the White House has been pressing hard for it. Indiana could become the seventh state to approve new congressional maps. The vote came a day after the Supreme Court approved Texas's new districts. Justice Samuel Alito says the maps were drawn for partisan advantage, which wouldn't violate the Voting Rights Act rule against racial gerrymandering. Florida is also working on a redistricting plan, but state law prohibits drawing districts for partisan benefit or to help incumbents. Republican State Representative Mike Redondo, chair of House Redistricting, promises the new maps will fit in those guidelines, despite what he calls external pressure.
Our work will only relate to congressional redistricting. We will not discuss hypotheticals outside of our control or engage in partisan punditry. We will follow the United States and Florida constitutions.
Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth is providing more detail on how an alleged drug boat was attacked on September 2nd. Two survivors were killed while they clung to the capsized and burning wreckage. Hegseth denies a Washington Post report that he gave orders that all the planned strikes have to, quote, kill them all. He insists the attacks on Venezuela are legal and justified.
These are the most professional Americans going through specific processes about what they can and cannot do, understanding all the authorities, all the laws of war, all the capabilities, and applying it to deter our adversaries.
The administration calls the attacks, quote, non-international armed conflict with designated terrorist organizations. It argues that means the troops can't be prosecuted. ICE is now conducting immigration sweeps in New Orleans, and the Department of Homeland Security says it wants to make at least 5,000 arrests there over the next 2 months. Few people arrested in what's called the Catahoula Crunch have criminal records, and the city's mayor-elect Helena Moreno says there are visible impacts on the community.
We have businesses closing. We have workers afraid to show up. And ultimately, there is an economic impact.
Moreno and the city council have given ICE conditions for the operations to follow, including avoiding racial profiling, regularly reporting results, protecting due process, not wearing masks, and considering humanitarian issues. The administration is announcing a new $5,000 penalty for anyone illegally entering the U.S. The fee, approved in the federal budget megabill, applies to anyone 14 and older caught crossing the border. With 3 weeks left before Affordable Care Act subsidies expire, Congress is working to avoid massive health insurance premium sticker shock for millions. Republican leaders say they're working on a proposal, and Democrats have introduced a clean 3-year extension. Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer says this bill is Congress's last chance.
Republicans have no hope of solving this health care crisis on their own. They have no health care plan of their own whatsoever. They're far too divided.
President Donald Trump had floated, then backed away from supporting an extension. Some Republicans say they'll only go along if it includes ACA abortion restrictions. I'm Edwin J. Vieira for Pacifica Network and Public News Service.
You are listening to an end-of-year membership drive special of the KBOO Evening News. Our goal is to raise $75,000 by December 31st. We'd like to remind you that you can renew your KBOO membership or become a member at any time during this program by going online to kboo.fm/give. Stay tuned after this newscast for Coast Range Radio. At 6, it's Labor Radio. At 6:30, it's Prison Pipeline. Then at 7, stick around for Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather: Northwest Oregon and Southwest Washington are under a flood watch due to an atmospheric river coming in off of the Pacific Ocean. Be prepared for possible urban flooding and possible landslides on steep terrain. Expect an overnight low of 50. Tomorrow, the deluge continues. Look for an afternoon high of 57. Today in history, in 1980, John Lennon was assassinated in front of the Dakota Apartments in New York City by Mark David Chapman. The quote of the day is from John Lennon's song Imagine. "You may say I am a dreamer, but I'm not the only one. I hope someday you'll join us, and the world will live as one."
Native groups in Canada have received dozens of their artifacts back from the Vatican. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. More than 60 indigenous artifacts have been returned to Canada from the Vatican. As Dan Karpinchuk reports, First Nations, Inuit, and Métis leaders were on hand at Montreal's airport over the weekend to welcome them back.
There were 62 items in large crates on board the plane that landed on Saturday morning. Many Native leaders, as well as those involved in the repatriation efforts, were on hand. Some bowed as the crates were lowered onto the tarmac. For most, the objects on board were more than simply artifacts. One of those present was the National Chief of the Assembly of First Nations, Cindy Woodhouse-Nipanak.
This is an important and emotional moment for many First Nations across this country. I hope it will also be an important moment for all Canadians to consider the history and the future of this country. Reconciliation isn't one stop here. Reconciliation is every single day doing this work.
Indigenous leaders in Canada have been calling for years on the Vatican to repatriate the artifacts in its collection. They met with Pope Francis in Rome in 2022 to talk about the legacy of the residential schools. At the time, they were also given a private viewing of some of the objects held by the church. They included embroidered gloves, a kayak, and a sling for carrying a baby. Some Indigenous leaders say it's not about bringing home objects or artifacts, but about bringing home memories, bringing home the dignity and power that was taken from their ancestors. The artifacts will not be available for public viewing until sometime early next year. Nipanak also says there are more artifacts in the Vatican Museum, so the work to repatriate them will continue. For National Native News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk.
After finally being sworn in following a historic 7-week delay, Arizona Congresswoman Adelita Grijalva is using her first legislative act to fulfill a campaign promise she made to tribes across Indian country. KJZZ's Gabriel Pietrazio has more.
In 2015, her father, the late Raul Grijalva, first introduced the Save Oak Flat from Foreign Mining Act to protect an Apache holy site east of Phoenix by stopping a congressionally approved land exchange between the U.S. Forest Service and Resolution Copper.
So maybe the foreign company has millions and billions of dollars. We have a spirit.
A decade later, the fight isn't over. The controversial land swap has been put on hold until as early as next year, and the new congresswoman is taking on that mantle by reintroducing her dad's old bill.
The bar is very high. Again, this is new to me. Not new to the family, but new to me. I mean, I hear it even from Democrats. Mining is super important. Right, but none of the ore is staying here. It's all going to China.
As for Resolution Copper, the company tells KJZZ, Grijalva has been invited to meet their workforce to talk about what they call her highly concerning bill, which they say threatens hundreds of jobs today and billions of dollars for Arizona's future. For National Native News, I'm Gabriel Pietrazio.
The Cherokee Nation in Oklahoma is concluding its emergency food assistance response this month. The tribe issued a declaration of emergency in October after the federal government announced the suspension of SNAP benefits for recipients in November. The declaration tapped millions of dollars in the tribe's reserve funds for cash assistance for Cherokee citizens and support for food pantries, meal sites, and food banks. According to the Cherokee Nation, the tribe delivered nearly $2 million in assistance to individuals and nonprofits. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Sudden cardiac arrest is the number one cause of death on school campuses, and a new bill in Olympia would require schools to have a cardiac emergency response plan, CERP. Using CPR and an AED quickly can more than double the rate of survival of sudden cardiac arrest. Isabel Charlet reports.
New legislation backed by the American Heart Association would require all Washington schools to have a cardiac emergency response plan in place, known as a CERP. Nationally, it's estimated that about 23,000 children under the age of 18 experience cardiac arrest outside of a hospital every year. Ryan Schaefer is a registered nurse and works with Project Adam, which has been supporting Washington schools to put CERPs in place. He says most schools in the state already have automated external defibrillators, or AEDs, but don't have a plan for how to use them.
Oftentimes we hear no one's been trained, no one oversees it, it hasn't been integrated into the EMS system. And when an event happens, the AED just stands on the wall and nobody's really sure what to do with it.
Schaefer explains a SERP outlines how to maintain AEDs, serves as a blueprint for how those devices will get to where they're needed, and designates school staff to be part of a response team that is integrated with EMS. House Bill 1863 is sponsored by Representative Alicia Rule of Blaine. Melinda Truax's son Matthew died from sudden cardiac arrest while running track at his high school in 2013. She says he had passed his sports physical, which often does not detect heart issues. SERP drills need to be weaved into existing safe school plans, she adds, to ensure they happen on an annual basis.
If the SERP bill is passed, it can double the survival rate from sudden cardiac arrest by empowering people to dial 911, start CPR, and use an AED.
After her son's passing, Truax started volunteering with Nick of Time, a group that provides youth heart screenings and trains students on CPR and how to use an AED. Nick of Time is now part of the Washington Smart Hearts Coalition in support of the SERP bill. For Public News Service, I'm Isabel Charlet.
Idaho public lands advocates have concerns about President Donald Trump's pick to head the U.S. Bureau of Land Management. Steve Pierce is a former New Mexico congressman and oil executive. He has expressed support for selling off public lands in the past. Eric Tegetoff has the story.
Public lands advocates in the West are urging Congress not to confirm President Donald Trump's nominee to head the U.S. Bureau of Land Management. The BLM manages nearly 12 million acres of land in Idaho, or more than a fifth of the state's land mass. Trump's nominee is Steve Pierce, a former New Mexico congressman and oil executive. John Robison with the Idaho Conservation League says environmental groups did not believe the Trump administration would nominate someone friendly to their interest, but did not think the nominee would be someone seemingly intent on selling off most of the land he's tasked with overseeing.
What we didn't expect is to see someone who has a track record and a vision for not having public lands in the future. And so that really is what makes Steve Pierce stand out in terms of a particularly inappropriate candidate.
Robison says Pierce's goal may be to dismantle the BLM. The former New Mexico congressman has also aligned himself with the anti-government Bundys, although he distanced himself from their tactics in the 2016 occupation of Oregon's Malheur National Wildlife Refuge. Supporters of Pierce's nomination have touted his qualifications, saying he will help with the Trump administration's mission to develop more energy resources, including fossil fuels, on federal lands. Efforts to make selling off public land easier failed in Congress this year. Robison says that's in part because of opposition from Idaho's congressional delegation.
Senator Risch, Senator Crapo, Congressman Simpson worked hard to see that language removed and to make sure that public lands stay in public hands.
Robison notes that Risch is on the Senate Energy and Natural Resources Committee, which will vet Pierce, and so he will play an important role in the nomination process. Robison says the director of the BLM is important for Idahoans.
We go camping with our kids. We go touring across the backcountry and recreating out there. And they're also an economic force multiplier for our rural communities. So public lands really make Idaho what it is and make Idahoans who they are.
For Northern Rockies News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
Canadian-American architect Frank Gehry passed away on Friday. He was known for his sculptural designs and innovative use of titanium and steel. Reporter Lizard has more.
Pritzker Prize-winning architect Frank Gehry dies at 96. He was born February 28, 1929 in Toronto, Canada. He found his passion for architectural design as a kid. His grandmother, Leah Kaplan, would entertain him with scraps of wood from her husband's hardware store, building elaborate and futuristic cities with him. His use of steel, chain-link fencing, and plywood in his work is inspired by spending time with his grandmother and grandfather. In 1947, Gehry's family emigrated to the United States, settling in California. He got a simple job driving a delivery truck while studying at Los Angeles City College. Gehry stated in an interview by the Academy of Achievement, "I was a truck driver in LA, going to City College, and I tried radio announcing, which I wasn't very good at. I tried chemical engineering, which I wasn't very good at and didn't like. And then I remembered, you know, somehow I just started racking my brain about, like, what do I like? Where was I? What made me excited? And I remembered art, that I loved going to museums, and that I loved looking at paintings, loved listening to music. Those things came from my mother, who took me to concerts and museums. I remembered grandma and the blocks, and just on a hunch, I tried some architecture classes." Gehry attended and graduated from University of Southern California School of Architecture in 1954. He spent time away from architecture until 1956, when he moved to Cambridge, Massachusetts. While in Cambridge, she studied city planning at Harvard University's Graduate School of Design. Gehry always expressed a socialist philosophy for architecture. He felt these ideas were underrepresented and rejected by his professors at Harvard, leaving him to feel disheartened and underwhelmed. This led him to eventually dropping his graduate program at Harvard. He moved back to Los Angeles to work for a company he apprenticed with while attending USC. Here, he was given his first chance to design a private residence, later to be known as the David Cabin. The David Cabin shows multiple elements that would follow him throughout his later works, including exposed beams, vertical grain Douglas fir detailing, and multiple inspirations from traditional Asian architecture. In 1962, he established his own practice in LA, where he would design a number of innovative commercial and residential buildings. Gehry's most famous piece, his own home renovation, was built during this time, featuring a corrugated metal exterior wrapped around the original house, leaving much of the original detail intact. In 1989, Gehry received the Pritzker Architecture Prize, where he was described as open to expression and compared to Picasso. He continued to design other buildings, including the Guggenheim Museum Bilbao, Frederick Weissman Museum of Art, Dr. Chow Chok Wing Building at the University of Technology Sydney, and 8 Spruce Street in New York, famously built 1 foot taller than Trump Tower, the then tallest residential building in New York. He passed on December 5th in his home due to a brief respiratory illness. His message and support for knowledge, art, and equity was persistent through his life and will be preserved throughout his body of work. For KBOO News, I'm Lizard.
You just happen to be listening to an end-of-year membership drive special of the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-801-1378. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Anna Wilcox, Dave Johnson, and Lizard. The producer and engineer is Althea Billings. Special thanks to Suzanne Potter, Terry D., Antonia Gonzalez, Edwin J. Vieira, Eric Tegatoff, and Isabel Charlet. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM.